everyone, and welcome to the third episode of the TateCast. My name is Davis Matic. You can find me on Twitter at Davis Matic. I'm here with none other than the Mac himself, Evan Silva. You guys all know where to find him. I'm sure if you follow me on Twitter, you follow Evan. One of the things I for sure wanted to do when I decided to start this podcast was talk to Evan, but not talk to him about who he thinks is going to score the most touchdowns in week three. I didn't want to just talk about daily fantasy football or preview fantasy football or anything kind of stupid like that, but maybe some more larger questions. And I think that part of our discussion is going to be spurred on by what we did in the last episode with Josh Hermsmeyer at Frisco Josh. If you haven't heard that episode, definitely go and give it a listen. Evan, I know that you listened to that episode and were pretty impressed with what Josh had to say on some of the analytics, NFL sort of stuff that he had the inside knowledge on.
Yeah, he's a super, super smart dude. You know, anytime I listen to him, whether he's doing the Man's podcast or, you know, your podcast, he has a lot of great insights to bring to the table. He has a book coming out, I think. I'm not sure it's coming out this year, but I'm excited to read it. And he's going to be doing, I think, a lot of data work over the next 2 months. And maybe he can tell us, you know, give us some advantages as to how to better make decisions when it comes to playing fantasy football. And also to just give us some better insights into how NFL teams operate on the field. Because, I mean, he's going to be using play-by-play data. And he's already been talking about routes on Twitter and, you know, so he'll have a lot of great insights. I would encourage anyone to follow him at Frisco Josh.
Absolutely. That was a really good discussion. I didn't really know. I had not had a ton of interaction with Josh outside of just on Twitter. So it was a very good interaction for me and a conversation where I was able to learn, which is, you know, I didn't really know exactly what would happen with this podcast and with that interview. So that was really cool to be able to learn and to be kind of experiencing it the same way that that a listener did. But Evan, I don't really think you need a ton of introduction. You are the senior football editor at rotoworld.com. But I mean, to me, you represent someone who's very serious about the game of football in a way that I respect and also in a way that I relate to, because I think you and I tend to have a lot of similar opinions on the game. And so with that in mind, we have an agenda set here, and let's just go ahead and get started with the first question. You and I both do not want to spend the whole episode talking about the Browns and Sashi and the whole dramatics there. I think both of us have very strong opinions about that. But I do think it is a good way to start our conversation as sort of a microcosm of what you have termed on Twitter to be the cocoon. And the cocoon is this, you know, large envelope that keeps the NFL as what it's been for the last 40 years. They hire the same coaches, the same scouts. They reject new ideas. And really what it does is it lets teams that do choose to innovate, it lets them run laps around everyone. And the question I want to start our discussion with is, over the last, you know, 5 to 10 years, do you see signs that teams are learning, or do you kind of believe that the cocoon is still largely intact?
Oh, yeah, the cocoon is alive and well. You might have seen the Seahawks hire Brian Schottenheimer as their offensive coordinator. I mean, what the heck was that? Or the Panthers have 7 members of Norv Turner's family on their staff. 7 Turners employed by the Panthers. If you listen to Josh's appearance on your show last week, you heard that Next Gen Stats / Zebra held a meeting after the season to introduce their new data to teams. Only 11 people showed up to the meeting, not representatives from 11 teams, not 11 team officials, 11 people, and 3 of them were from the Patriots. And whatever the heck John Gruden is doing in Oakland, I think that a lot of indications cocoon sort of strategy there. The circus act that Dave Gettleman is putting on with the Giants, John Gruden basically admitted that he thought that letting players listen to hip-hop music during practices is analytics. Dave Gettleman ripped analytics in his post-draft press conference after passing on Sam Darnold and Josh Rosen for a running back. NFL team representatives and football guys are always taking pot shots at Pro Football Focus. There have been some positive signs, though. I think that the Eagles really are the shining example of that. Of course, the Super Bowl champs, they've spoken publicly about how invested they are in analytics. Whereas, you know, you have Bill Belichick sending three representatives to, you know, the next gen zebra meeting and, you know, pretending that, you know, pretending to have no knowledge of analytics whatsoever. The Eagles have actually spoken outwardly about it. They pump success rates and win probabilities into Doug Peterson's ear before every play call. Their defensive coordinator, Jim Schwartz, gives his players heat maps that show opponent tendencies, like what section of the field do most of an opponent's deep balls go. The Eagles went for it on fourth down more than any team in the NFL, actually over the last 2 years. And Howie Roseman has talked about how they use sports science to monitor and improve health. And Frank Reich, the Colts' new head coach, he was the Eagles' offensive coordinator last year. He's talked about how he's going to bring some of those same forward-thinking ideas to Indianapolis. Frank Reich is big on questioning conventional wisdom in the NFL, and he's very right to do that because so much conventional wisdom in the NFL is wrong and outright misleading. And the Broncos brought in Sam Hinkie as a pre-draft consultant, and the Browns made a very unconventional pick at number one on Baker Mayfield, who's obviously a darling in the analytics community. But absolutely. I mean, I believe that the cocoon is still very strong. We actually had a guy work for RotoWorld last offseason for a little bit. He got a job with an NFL team. He spent all of last season working in that team's building. That team didn't even have an analytics department at all. So I think that the levels of innovation and use of technology differ from team to team, but there's still a huge edge or market inefficiency that can be exploited by the teams that are ahead and looking ahead. And last year's Eagles were a tremendous testament to that with how quickly they were able to become the best team in the game.
That's really interesting that you bring up the concept of market inefficiencies, because I think the NFL is kind of one of the only leagues where it still exists to that degree. You know, every Major League Baseball team, even the poor ones, even the ones that are ran by, you know, baseball men, they all have analytics departments. The big European soccer clubs, I mean, they're monitoring the hours that these guys sleep. They're monitoring every food stuff that any of their players eat. And I just think it's very interesting that what is the biggest sports business in the United States, they refuse to innovate, because you don't really see that in many multi-billion dollar industries. Like I can't really think of another multi-billion dollar industry that is anti-innovation on purpose.
And I think that the fact that they make so much money contributes to the cocoon, and it contributes to team officials, guys that run teams, not even necessarily wanting to look into analytics and more just wanting to stroke their egos and be football guys and, you know, pound their chests. And they can get away with it because their teams are making so much money. You know, so at the end of the day, how do you win? You find a competitive advantage on your opponent and you exploit it until they submit, you know? And I think that teams are not really interested in that. I mean, at the end of the day, would they prefer to win? Of course they would, but they don't have to prioritize winning above all and trying to find competitive advantages because their teams are so, so profitable. And, you know, they can just employ Mike Tannenbaum for, you know, a decade and, you know, go 8-8 or worse in 8 of the last 9 seasons and make no advancements and show no improvement and stay employed because Stephen Ross, the owner, is just raking in loot.
So I guess that is something that's pretty interesting. And I don't ever see that talking point brought up on Twitter when people talk about things like that. Like when anytime there's a big debate about, you know, fourth down, you know, going forward on fourth down versus the more conservative route, very rarely would you see the talking point brought up that pretty much anyone who owns an NFL team right now is going to be generating profit regardless of the decisions that they make in the front office and regardless of the decisions that the coach makes on the field. And I've never even heard that point made, that hampers innovation. But yeah, I think a lot of these guys who are, you know, successful businessmen first probably have bad experiences with having to shake things up at their corporations or with the technology that they're involved in. And they probably see no reason or no clear benefit to doing it with their football teams, because it could definitely make the product worse and it could definitely make people not like the product if it truly was revolutionary on the field.
Well, and because they're raking in so much money, they can afford to just hire their friends. You know, nepotism is so common throughout the NFL at every level. I mean, it's like a sport that is just run by a bunch of families. So they're not, you know, hiring people from different walks of life and data analysts and financial analysts. And they are, they just hire their friends. And, you know, they're, again, they're able to sustain because of how much money they're making.
That that point actually works excellently with the next question that we're going to talk about. A fairly forgotten book, I think, in our space, but something that most people involved, definitely people who listen to this podcast would like, is The Game Plan by Frank DuPont. He founded RotoViz. You might know him on Twitter as The Fantasy Douche. But a big foundational piece of what he wrote is he just detailed how all of these organizations, these multi-billion dollar industries, everyone's related. You know, you're more likely to get a head coaching NFL job from marrying an owner's daughter than you are through working up through the ranks. Nepotism, as you said, Evan, is just this big, giant deal in the NFL. And an idea that I had while reading the book, and a link to the book will be in the show notes, was what would happen if an NFL team, say some millennial money bought an NFL team, and they hired either a head coach or an offensive coordinator who not only had not played football, but just was not experienced in football, and their job was, you know, they were a philosopher or a logician or a data analyst, and all they were trying to do was make the most analytically correct or most logically correct decisions. What would that look like on the field, and what percent chance of success would you give that experiment?
I think that the better route to take here is to do what many teams have done in baseball and basketball, and that's hire data analysts or financial analysts to actually run teams as GMs and front office personnel. I think that what you want to do at the coaching level is to find coaches who have experience coaching, who have the respect of players, and they're also open to questioning the conventional wisdom like Frank Reich, or they're open to innovative ways to create competitive advantages like what Sean McVay did with Jared Goff last year, where it's Goff and the offense rushing to the line of scrimmage, and then McVay and Matt LaFleur up in the press box. You know, LaFleur and McVay are reading the coverages and they're calling audibles before the snap. So you're just making life so much easier on your quarterback just by tweaking this one way that NFL teams have always done it, and just kind of speeding up the process and making your team and your offense and your quarterback more efficient. I think that the problem, though, is that a lot of like goofball non-football guys who have they've really ruined this for other people, like Tannenbaum and Bruce Allen of the Redskins. And the hiring process for GMs and front office personnel is just shrouded in the cocoon. One really popular way, maybe the most popular way for teams to find GMs, is to hire this old guy, former GM named Ernie Accorsi, to do it for them. Every year, you know, Ernie Accorsi is putting GMs and coaches on teams. He's like placing them, and he just gets his friends hired. He's the guy who put John Fox in Chicago. He's the guy that gave Dave Gettleman to the Giants. So there are major roadblocks in the way of real progress, but I think that you really want to use – I think that at the front office – level, that's where you want to really look into you know, hiring guys that are true like forward thinkers. And then at the coaching level, you want to find coaches that are open to doing things a little bit differently. Because I mean, you know, anybody who's played DFS, it's like the guys that are really good at DFS, they're also really good at game theory. And they know that you have to do things a little bit different, you know, most of the time to be able to really climb the charts.
Yeah, I think that the space is definitely, I think even the Patriots, I think it's all crying out for new ideas. And I think that it's something that isn't even apparent. Something I read in a book recently is that it's harder to go from 0 to 1 than it is to go from 1 to 100. And I think I mentioned that on the podcast with Josh as well. And I think that there are definitely ideas in football that are the one, going from 0 to 1, that we have not even found yet. But I know for sure that anyone who's ever been related to Dave Gettleman is not going to go from 0 to 1. And I don't know if the problem lies with the coaching or with the front offices, but I really want one team to just be an experiment, you know, for there to be a crowdfunded team or something like that, where it's just all the bad ideas and the good ideas that football Twitter could have to throw out, because there are so many ideas for professional football specifically that we will never get to test. And actually, this is not a question that we have on our agenda, but something that a lot of people talk about this. This is not a new idea for me, but there are basically college teams that don't run the ball at all. Like every play is just a passing play. And this has been something I've said for years. It's just like, if I was a coach, I would just pass every play. You know more about actual football than I do. You are more of like a football, you know, you know the deal more than me. Tell me the football guy argument against that. Like, what would a really smart football person tell me? You can't do that in the NFL because blank.
Oh, it all refers back to conventional wisdom. Their best argument might be that running the ball is a mentality, and you want to have a physical football team, and it's a very physical sport, and it's kind of the way that you can impose your will on your opponent is by just running the ball down their throat, okay? That's all like feel and narrative based. And at the end of the day, I think that it originates with just what people learned growing up. And, you know, the Eagles, like, they're challenging conventional wisdom. Frank Reich talks about challenging conventional wisdom. Sean McVay challenged conventional wisdom. Chip Kelly had, you know, a short run. He kind of challenged conventional wisdom. Pro Football Focus challenges conventional wisdom. Howie Roseman is challenging conventional wisdom. That would be my best argument, though, for, like, it's like a toughness and physicality factor. We can't dismiss the fact that football is a very physical sport, and there is a lot of, you know, mental domination that you want to, you know, you want to dominate your opponent mentally as well. And I think that you can do that with the running game, or at least that's what the coaches and old school football guys believe. And I think that there is a level of truth to that. But when you want that to be is in the fourth quarter, when you're up by 17 points and you can give the ball to LeGarrette Blount 12 times in a row on a drive and finish the game and pound your opponent into submission.
I think that the players oftentimes do believe stuff like that too. You see this in basketball a lot, where former players tend to just have these horrible opinions that are not backed up by analytics or math at all. And I think that it's probably true for all major sports, where athletes tend to make their decisions and their judgments based on their experience. And I think that ties into something that was the most interesting talking point to me on the show last week with Josh. Was we both said that we think the right decision, or the thing we would have wanted to do, would have been to take Mayfield and Rosen. But I disagreed on its viability. I think that it probably would have not disagreed on its viability, but that if you decide Baker's the guy, you're not getting anything like fair market value for Rosen. Like, I don't think you're getting a first round pick back for him if you decide Mayfield's the guy 4 months later we're trading Rosen. And I wanted you to weigh in on that discussion. Which side do you land on, getting fair market value for Rosen, or are you getting a third back for him?
Yeah, it was a very interesting discussion. I actually disagreed with you on what you could get back for Rosen. But I do agree that he would lose value. It's just, I think that a team would still be willing to give up a one for him. Especially because this 2019 quarterback class is not expected to be good. So that would kind of work in your favor. You definitely want to think forward and, you know, see, well, how are we assessing the 2019 quarterback class? And, you know, and I think that there would be a situation, and I think Josh brought this up, where a quarterback gets hurt in training camp, and, hey, we have an opportunity to give up our 2019-1 and maybe a little bit more for Josh Rosen. And that could be beneficial to the team that is taking the two quarterbacks as well. But it was a very interesting discussion. I honestly kind of agreed with you on some things and agreed with him on some things. But I would encourage anybody to go back and listen to that.
All right, moving on to this is a little bit more of a theoretical discussion, but it's been something that I've kind of been interested in recently. The idea of algorithmic play calling. I haven't really seen this discussed much, but I don't think that anyone would argue that the human brain is 100% always the best rational decision maker. And something that also doesn't get discussed a lot is you have 40 seconds to call plays. Right? Like the human brain, we already know, doesn't make the best decisions. You give it 40 seconds. Again, a lot of these coaches, a lot of these offenses are based on presets. You know, they have scripted plays. They have things they know to do in down and distance. But now that we know that NFL teams 100% have player tracking data, as you mentioned earlier, they have heat maps, they have tendencies. Computers can take in all of this information and movements and performance of a 45-man roster way more than a head coach or assistant coach or a coordinator ever could. And I kind of think that perhaps a computer could call better plays, better coverages, better blocking assignments, point things out that an opposition is doing more than a coach could. And I don't see this as being particularly likely, but do you think that this sort of automation is something that would work or even is possible given all the variables?
Again, I think that your best approach here is to find a coach who's willing to listen and understand the advantages that you get from listening to success rates and win probabilities before each play, like Doug Peterson, because those success rates and win probabilities are going to be generated by the predictive algorithms. I just don't think we'll get to a point in the near future where the play caller is just eliminated and a computer takes over. I think that the sport will be outlawed because of concussions before we get to that point. So I think that your best bet is to just teach coaches and get them to buy in. And for the play callers who are making the decisions without success rates and win probabilities, which is the vast majority of the league, their in-game decision-making can be so irrational because, you know, like you get a first and 10, okay, and your pass play gets broken up. So you're on to second and 10. And many coaches will run a play on second and 10 only because they don't want to go three and out with three straight pass plays. That's the driving force of their decision-making. They don't want to go three and out with three straight passes. And we know that running the ball on second and 10 is just overwhelmingly suboptimal, but these play callers are willing to make suboptimal decisions just so they don't feel bad at the end of the series. Or they punt on fourth and one near midfield because they're scared to go for it. Right now, I'm helping edit Warren Sharp's book, which comes out later this summer. And Warren noted that Rick Dennison, who was the Bills' offensive coordinator last year, he called a run play on 81% of second and 10 plays. 81% of the time, Rick Dennison called a run play on second and 10. The Bills had a 12% success rate on those second and 10 runs, and they averaged 3.2 yards per carry. So these play callers that are not using data to improve their in-game decision-making and the teams that employ these guys are putting themselves at, like, proactively putting themselves at disadvantages. And I think that they're not prioritizing winning.
I think that sort of decision-making is obvious, but this is also something I really hear from our conversation and kind of in thinking about it in general is that there is definitely an element of football and probably of all athletic competition, but really specifically the game of football, it's very hard to codify, right? Like there's just something about the game of American professional football that you just cannot really so much put into numbers and maybe not even specific words. And do you think it's kind of, has it gone too far the other way with some of the analytics stuff? Because I know there are right now in the NBA, That's the discussion on Twitter right now. Is everyone is talking about how the NBA?
I knew that this would happen because the Rockets missed 25 threes in a row.
Right, that's all the talk on Twitter is that the analytics have gone too far. I am not of that opinion, but people are saying that, and I'm 100% certain people say that about the
analytics. The Rockets also didn't have Chris Paul. Like, can we talk about that?
We can. Yeah.
Okay, because that's probably a likelier reason that they lost than them making good decisions during the game and teaching their players to how to make the most efficient decisions on the court in terms of their shot selection.
Well, the biggest reason that the Warriors won is that they have Steph Curry and Kevin Durant on the same roster?
Yeah, that helps. Getting great players is another great way to gain a competitive advantage on your opponent. No question. Probably the best way.
You know, if you really think about it, the genius of analytics, and it's the genius of analytics, is that you're able to take away what players do poorly and emphasize what they do well. And I think a huge disconnect that the public has from the message of analytics is, and really the players, is they don't want to hear about what they can't do. You don't want to hear about what your team sucks at. You don't want, as a player, you don't want to hear about what you're bad at. And I think that's a bad message from the analytics community, is overt criticism. I don't think that wins anyone over to the argument that analytics is the way to produce winning sports, you know?
Yep, I hear you. I mean, but again, what is analytics? You know, it's just, it's pretty basic. I mean, I've heard Paul D. Podesta talk about this. It's just using information to improve your decisions, you know? And that can be, I mean, that can be watching tape. You know, that's, hey, if you have someone who's legitimately good at watching tape and has done it for a lot of years and is able to, like, diagnose little subtle nuances that a particular player can bring to the table that might increase their probability of being a good NFL player, you're using data to make a better decision when you select that player in the draft.
I think there are some really hilarious examples of this draft that are going to be, like, they're going to be in books 10 years from now, the Josh Allen decision, and any team that has traded up in the last 5 years, sort of since teams became hip to the idea of getting more picks. I mean, I do think it is. I actually think trading up in the first round is, like, the most disastrous thing that a franchise can do. Like, giving up a first round pick is, it's from a mathematical perspective, it's just like a nightmare for your franchise. It's horrible, and it's something we know is horrible, and teams still do it.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And the Bills actually traded up twice. They not only did they trade up for Josh Allen, this quarterback from Wyoming who made honorable mention All Mountain West behind Nick Stevens, Packers camp arm, and Brett Rippon, a projected 7th round undrafted free agent in 2019. They also traded up for Tremaine Edmonds at number 16 overall, a 19-year-old linebacker out of Virginia Tech. So they're all in on the trading up strategy.
A question about the first round, and I have not heard your opinion on this, but what do you think, what do you make of the Patriots taking a running back in the first round, spending a first-round pick on a running back?
I mean, look, if Saquon Barkley had fallen to number 7 in the Buccaneers and they had taken him, and, you know, they have, I think Jameis Winston is a franchise quarterback. I know that a lot of people consider him a disappointment. He actually had some of his best metrics last year. He was really good in the final 4 or 5 games, but he battled a shoulder injury, and people just don't like him, you know. Mm-hmm. But you have your franchise quarterback. You have Mike Evans and DeSean Jackson and Chris Godwin and, you know, Cameron Brait and O.J. Howard, and you feel okay about your offensive line. And you went out in the offseason, you acquired Jason Pierre-Paul and Vinnie Curry to stabilize your defensive line rotation. You know, you could view Saquon Barkley as like the final piece, you know, and just maybe elevate your offense, the dimensions that your offense brings, because, you know, otherwise you have Peyton Barber and Ronald Jones. That's what they have right now. Ronald Jones has never been a passing game contributor, and Peyton Barber is just like a replacement level grinder, you know. So if you do get Saquon Barkley, he gives you a lot more dimensions offensively. I think that in that situation, I would support that pick for sure. I think that it's a case by – so ultimately I think it's a case-by-case situation. But I think that the devaluation of running backs is absolutely real. Where the debate comes in, though, with like a guy like Saquon Barkley, is that he has like David Johnson level receiving ability. So he's not just, you know, some traditional, you know, banger. I mean, he's a guy who can, like, you could line him up at wide receiver. You know, he could probably be like a starting slot receiver in the NFL if he really put his mind to it. But you know, that's where the debate kind of changes. I think that he is a much better pick than like Leonard Fournette, who is limited in the passing game.
And that's a new age sort of argument. most smart football people are not making the argument that, you know, running backs matter, or maybe not even that they matter, but that it's so hard to project the game breakers that it's not worth spending a first round pick on them. But I do think that if you have an offense in place, and this is where the front office coaching relationship is really important. If you have a scheme in place where you're going to be targeting your running backs, you know, 90 to 120 times a year, I do think it softens personally my stance a little bit on taking a running back in the first round. Like if you're going to give your lead back 200 carries and 85 targets, I think that's a more valuable player than someone that you're going to give 250 carries and 20 targets. Like David Johnson probably would have been worth a first round pick given his production, whereas Ezekiel Elliott, given his production, not a first round pick. And that's just kind of the changing nature of a game. Like football looks different every single year now because of how fast things are changing.
I like how you brought up Ezekiel Elliott, because this dude has led the NFL in rushing yards per game in each of his first two NFL seasons. And yet you can look back at their decision to draft him over Jalen Ramsey, and it still looks so egregious. Like, it was a terrible decision, despite the fact that Ezekiel Elliott has done what he's supposed to do, lead the NFL in rushing yards per game in each of his first two NFL seasons. And it was still just an abysmal decision by the team. And they're still trying to figure out what to do at cornerback.
I can't get into more Cowboys sadness. Just all of that decision-making is really horrible for me, and the whole situation of that team makes me sad to care about their results, and I've tried to divorce myself from it. I've really tried to stop caring about whether or not they win football games, and it's just something that's so inbred in me from such a young age that it's really hard. I don't even actually know this about you. Do you root for any NFL team? Do you care if any team wins or loses?
No, I have a strong dislike for all teams. I like players. I like fantasy football. I respect teams that do smart things. You know, I respect the Eagles. I largely respect the Patriots. You know, I think that the Colts are headed in the right direction. I like it when teams do smart things. Problem is that 22 out of 32 teams are just doing constant dumb things. And so that is really annoying. And, you know, I have no team affiliation whatsoever.
Well, I think we can both agree that we hate the Raiders more than any other team. That's easily public enemy number one. We hate the Raiders.
I don't want to say that, but I think that they're doing dumb things.
All right. To close out our analytics discussion, I wanted to ask you, do you believe that the game of football is solvable? I.e., is it possible to play the game perfectly? The NBA, I would say, is pretty close to being a solved game. You shoot three-pointers and you try to make layups and dunks. You either are shooting from, you know, three-point range or from the restricted area, and you never shoot from 18 feet unless you have to. You know, there are a lot of like limit poker games that are solved. Like, it's just sort of a game theory thing. So do you believe that the equivalent could exist in the NFL? Is there a game theory optimal way to play professional football, or is it just too much of a chaotic game for that to ever exist?
I think that the answer is yes, probably yes, that there's an optimal way to play. I'm not entirely sure what it is, but my sense is that the league trends are moving in that direction, because we're to the point where the game is almost 65% pass and 35% run. And we know teams are still run, but they're still running too much. It's an inefficient play 9 times out of 10 compared to a pass. And each year those percentages lead more and more toward the pass, and the average depth of target, the average depth of target across the NFL is dropping every single year. So by dropping your A dot and the distance of throws and the time that it takes for quarterbacks to execute their drop back and deliver the ball, you're offsetting pass rush and you're making your opponent's highest value defensive players less relevant. So, teams go to great lengths to sign for big money and use very high draft picks on pass rushers. And so when you're getting the ball out of your quarterback's hands quickly, you are minimizing the pass rush impact on the game. And I think that the Patriots and the Eagles, this is a little bit different, but I think that the Patriots, Eagles, and Rams maybe onto something with NFL draft optimization. All these teams seem to have realized that how low probability and hard to predict the NFL draft really is. So they're using their draft picks as currency to either trade down or out of drafts, or they're using their picks to acquire proven NFL players, guys who have shown that they can play in the league already. This past year, the Patriots turned their 7 draft picks into 15 players. They got Trent Brown, who might be their immediate starter at left tackle, to replace Nate Solder, Cordero Patterson, who's the best kickoff returner in the league, Danny Shelton, who's a great young role player, run stopper, Jason McCourty, who's going to be their number 2 cornerback opposite Stephon Gilmore, and Marquise Flowers and Eric Rowe, who both play key roles on defense. And then they drafted 9 guys. And then they also used their picks to acquire the Bears' second-round pick next year and the Lions' third-round pick next year. So 15 players and the Bears' second and the Lions' third next year. So they're really milking value out of their draft picks and optimizing the process and creating an edge on the teams who still think that they can beat the draft. The Patriots know that year over year, they can't outdraft other teams. You know, they've been down that road, and that's why they trade down, and that's why they trade their picks for veteran players that have already shown the ability to, that they can play in the NFL.
I think that's a giant market inefficiency that exists, because NFL teams are a great example of preferring the devil that you don't know over the devil that you do. Like they just, NFL teams don't want to part with a 5th-round draft pick for a player who can come in and play snaps for them right away. But it's fairly common for 5th-round picks to not even make teams. So I definitely think that the mystery and the allure of draft picks, very few teams properly value those, either undervaluing or overvaluing them. Like the Bills would definitely be a team that has shown little to no ability to properly evaluate a draft pick at all. It's like funny money to them. Like they're trying to pay the piper with Josh Allen. Like I don't know. It's not going to work. Changing lanes a little bit though, I do want to talk about kind of the industry that you and I are both involved in and the impact that sports betting legalization is going to have on fantasy sports. Because betting games is way easier than fantasy is. You don't have to do a draft. You don't have to remember to be anywhere on time. You don't have to deal with lineups and whatever, like paying league dues. You either make the bet or you don't. You either have the money in your account or you don't. And, you know, you saw the DFS boom change the industry that you are in, that you were the forefront in. I mean, fantasy analysis today looks entirely different than it did 5 years ago, both in terms of the interest, and you can charge way more for fantasy analysis now because people are more invested. Like, you can charge whatever you want for DFS content and people will pay it pretty much. Like, it's absurd how much you can charge for projections or articles or whatever. And I kind of just wanted to get your opinion on what you think this industry will look like a year or 5 years from now based on this legalization.
Well, I think it's going to take a while, I think, for states to go to their legislatures and pass sports betting bills. So I'm not, expecting an immediate impact, although I could be wrong about that. But I do think that sports betting will be great for the fantasy industry, because people that really want to give themselves the best chance to win at sports betting are going to end up looking to fantasy analysts for guidance, because the industry uses real data to make projections, and we keep getting better at it every single year. So whereas so many of the sports betting touts that are out there right now give you nonsense trends like, oh, this team is 9-2-1 against the spread in its last 12 games after playing teams in red jerseys, or, oh, this team is 1-7 in its last 8 against the spread when it's coming off a bye, that might be interesting information, but I think it's flawed in terms of predictiveness. That's not real analytics. That's not information that we use to change or better our decision-making prospects. That's like fun facts.
Yeah, it's correlation, not causation.
Right. And people, unfortunately, buy into that stuff right now, but I think that that's going to change. And what we do in the fantasy industry is actual real game analysis. We talk about game flow. We closely monitor injuries to all impact players. We're very in tune with player usage and how good backups to injured starters are. Or are the backups really bad? You know, are the backups bad enough that, hey, you know, this team is going to use four backs in this game? Or are they, can they just give the full load to D'Angelo Williams and run their offense? We know where teams get beaten and why on the field, because the Browns use their free safety like a punt returner, and they leave three linebackers on the field in passing situations instead of pulling one out and replacing him with a defensive back to improve their coverage. And so the Browns get just demolished by tight ends every week. I mean, Tyler Croft is out here having career games against the Browns. And the Cardinals never fixed their problem at number two cornerback opposite Patrick Peterson. So we know that number two receivers going against Arizona, they have an increased probability of having a big game. The Broncos play man coverage at cornerback. They squash wide receiver production. Tom Brady's touchdown probability drops significantly whenever Rob Gronkowski misses a game. So those are some pretty basic examples, but that's actual real analysis that has predictive value, and that's not what sports betting touts right now discuss, but it's what fantasy analysts discuss. And it helps our chances of figuring out what's likely to happen in a specific game. And I mean, look, are we going to get everything right? No. You know, a good win rate for a sports bettor is around 60%. But I do think that we will be able to provide a lot more insight than what the current sports bettors are getting from the so-called touts.
I think anyone that does research on sports betting now would still use stuff that fantasy analysts are doing, because really there's no incentive to be providing the data that fantasy analysts provide in sports betting, because the bar is so low. Like, people like legit profit off a touting model where like they're talking about how teams do coming off a bye. Like, that's like a viable business. Like, if you think your favorite fantasy analyst is a dork, like, you have no idea how bad these like Vegas sports touts are. It's like legitimately hilarious. But I do think that something that DFS did was it really made analysts put skin in the game, or they would lose respect. Like, people would definitely take note if you did not have skin in the game. And I think sports betting is going to do the same thing. I think anything that gives more accountability to someone who's offering advice or specifically charging for advice is a good thing, because I do think having no culpability at all is bad and irresponsible. So I like when people show their results, or even not show your results, but just actively be playing DFS or sports gambling if it's going to be something that you're talking about.
I'm with you. I think that the fallout of sports, the legalization of sports betting, is going to be positive in 9 out of 10 respects. I think that the one group of individuals that may get hurt by this is like fans of teams that keep hoping that their terrible team is going to get better, because, you know, Mark Cuban talked about it, like the value of these organizations is going to skyrocket, maybe even double. So how we talked about, you know, early in the podcast, these teams are just raking in millions and billions of dollars. Well, guess what? They're going to be raking in even more money now. So the cocoon will live on.
The cocoon will absolutely live on. I think that's a good place for us to end. So everyone, thanks for listening to the show with Evan. If you have any thoughts or suggestions for the show, feel free to email me, davismatic@gmail.com. If you're interested in advertising or sponsoring the show, you can contact me there as well. And we will be back a little bit later with episode 4 of The Takecast.